This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Barbara Walters, a professor of international relations at the University of California, San Diego, and a permanent member of the Council on Foreign Relations. She specializes in, among other things, rebel insurgency. And in fact, she studied every civil war since the end of World War II in such places as Zimbabwe, Colombia, Northern Ireland, Syria, and the West Bank, engaging in research and interviews firsthand. In 2018, she found herself on a CIA task force charged with developing a model to help the U.S. government predict which countries were at highest risk for civil war. They gathered data on many factors, including poverty, income inequality, religion, and ethnic and racial composition. But two factors were far more predictive than all the rest.
The first was what we call anocracy. And that's just a fancy term for a country that's neither fully democratic nor fully autocratic. Some people call it partial democracy. Fareed Zakaria has called it illiberal democracy. But those are the countries that tended to be most likely to experience civil war. Turns out that if you're a full liberal democracy, you don't tend to experience civil war. If you're a full autocracy, you're also at lower risk of civil war. It's those countries in the middle that experience violence. The second factor, and this turns out to be even more important, is whether in these weakening partial democracies, citizens begin to organize themselves politically, not around ideology, but around identity. So they start forming ethnic or religious political parties or racially based parties with the goal of gaining power so that they can essentially exclude everyone else. So you could imagine I'm sitting in a conference room in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about Ukraine or we're talking about Iraq, and I'm watching as the U.S.'s democracy is declining, and we know that it has declined in the last 5 years. It was first downgraded in 2016 because of elections that were deemed not entirely fair. It was downgraded again in 2019 as a result of the refusal by the executive branch to answer subpoenas.
Downgraded by whom?
The Center for Systemic Peace, a nonprofit organization that every year gives countries a measure of the quality of their democracy. By the end of the Trump administration, the United States was downgraded to an anocracy for the first time since 1800. And so the United States is no longer considered the world's longest consistent democracy. That honor now goes to Switzerland.
Wow.
And again, the task force uses this one data set produced by the Center of Systemic Peace, but there are at least four other major data sets. One is by Freedom House. One is by a Swedish organization that produces a data set called The Varieties of Democracy. One is put out by the Economist Intelligence Unit. Every single one of these data sets, despite the fact that they measure democracy slightly differently, they have all downgraded the United States over the last 5 years. And so I'm watching this happening. And then, of course, when I'm thinking about ethnic factions, are we beginning to organize our political parties along racial lines? And the answer is yes. As late as 2008, white Americans were equally likely to vote for a Democrat as they were to vote for a Republican. That shifted after Obama came to power to the point where the Republican Party today is 90% white.
But the fact is the Republican Party has shrunk It may have a higher percentage of white people, but it's much smaller overall.
They understand that they are losing. They understand that in a system where one person has one vote, in a truly, fully democratic system, they cannot win.
Let me ask you about what is to be done in your view.
People ask me all the time, like, what's one of the simplest and easiest things we can do? And my answer is regulate social media. And I don't mean regulate content. We should regulate the ability of these companies to design recommendation engines that push disinformation far more than they push real information. We know that this is having the effect of pushing more and more extreme material in front of people, helping to radicalize them. We know that the best place to find and join a militia is online. I went to Facebook and I typed in militias in California, and I had dozens from which to choose to join. It happened in a matter of seconds. We regulate food, television. We should be regulating this really powerful tool as well.
I'm persuaded that there's violence afoot. I'm persuaded that people are organizing. And yet, the idea that there would be a long-running struggle to put somebody in the seat of power in Washington just at the point of a gun, I mean, we have a military. What would this actually look like?
Challenging the federal government for control of D.C., that's not going to happen. But power is decentralized down to the local level. I could see a situation where, for example, powerful militias emerge in a state like Michigan. Michigan is highly divided racially and in terms of the urban-rural split. Rural Michigan is almost entirely white, and urban Michigan is non-white. And so you could imagine a situation where those militias begin to coordinate, consolidate, and they start pursuing a strategy of intimidation, targeting a minority group or targeting opposition politicians, targeting judges that are not voting in your favor.
But then don't the feds come in?
This is where a concept called leaderless resistance comes in. If you read the Turner Diaries, that is the strategy that they are pursuing. They said, listen, we'll have no chance against the federal government if we have a hierarchical structure. But if we have a very horizontal structure, think about it almost as terrorist cells dispersed all over the country that are hard to find, that can move quite quickly. It's very hard to weed them out. That's the strategy that they would pursue.
And that's in the Turner Diaries, the kind of Bible for these groups.
Yes. By the way, the Turner Diaries talks about an attack on the Capitol. So you could read about it there as well.
Are you worried about inciting panic?
I'm not. If you look at videos of January 6th, people were wearing black t-shirts and black sweatshirts saying Civil War, January 6th, 2021. They're organizing whether we talk about it or not. And of course, if we begin to talk about it, we can begin to do something about it. And in fact, we just heard that the U.S. government is forming a new Department of Domestic Terrorism.
So what's the average U.S. citizen supposed to do with this information, besides lobbying for better controls on social media? What action do you hope to elicit?
Well, you know, I said earlier that full liberal democracies don't experience civil war. Strengthen our democracy. Demand that our government make reforms. Eliminate truly undemocratic features of our government that no other liberal democracy has, such as the filibuster, such as the Electoral College, such as partisan control over running elections and counting votes. If the government refuses to make any changes, popular nonviolent protests are really, really effective. There's a professor at the Kennedy School, Erica Chenoweth, who's probably the world's leading expert on nonviolent protests. And she very, very clearly reveals how effective individual citizens going out in the street, insisting that their governments make changes, how often that is successful. Don't underestimate the power of protests. And then the second thing is voting matters. The 2020 elections had the highest turnout in something like 120 years. It was enormous. And yet 80 million eligible voters still did not vote. That's an enormous amount of citizen power. So I would say be ready to get out in the street and to make your ire known. And second, go to the polls and vote.
Your book is called How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them. Let's say the worst happens. We'll see it happening on the local level. We'll see it happening through intimidation.
Yeah.
We'll see it happening through the suppression of the vote,
yeah,
which is being directed by Congress, a peculiar locus for civil war, perhaps. What do we do then?
Well, that's a very scary situation. What do you do if suddenly you hear gunfire? What do you do if you try to go to the grocery store and suddenly there's a roadblock manned by people with arms, but you don't know who these people represent?
But don't we have law enforcement and National Guard and military? I mean, I know the military isn't supposed to be deployed on our soil, but it has happened.
So I'll have two responses to that. The first is that we have multiple jurisdictions here in the United States. My guess is if you were to ask people on the street, okay, who do you think has jurisdiction in El Cajon in San Diego? Most people wouldn't know.
But we don't have to know.
But you do have to know, because if you go to the roadblock and they say, you know, the sheriff sent us, that roadblock could very well be run by the sheriff, but the sheriff could be a renegade. Mm. Do you remember a couple of weeks ago, three retired generals wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post, and they sounded the alarm that they could imagine that we are now at a point where our military has become partisan, and they could imagine a situation where if you had a ghost president, somebody who refused to accept the results of the election, and you then had a real president, that they could imagine the military splitting, with some of them supporting the ghost president, some of them supporting the real president. And that's a problem.
What do you think of the current debate? Are the media addressing the various issues, the controversies, the skepticism, which I think is natural among large parts of the population? Do you think they're being too skeptical?
Pre-January 6th, I would have said they're enormous blind spots. I would tell people I was writing this book, and they would look at me with pity because they thought I was completely off my rocker. And here we are a year later, and it's resonating with people. They feel it. They sense it. Joe Biden is finally aggressively talking about the need for democratic reform. All sorts of people are. So I actually think January 6th, 2021 was a gift to the American people, because it brought what we have been seeing lurking in the shadows out into the open. It made it impossible for our politicians and American citizens to ignore and deny what's been happening on the far right, the rapid growth of extremism in this country. And it's given us time to sound the alarm so we can begin to institute the reforms that are going to save us.
Barbara, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Barbara F. Walter is a professor of international relations at the University of California, San Diego, and a permanent member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Her new book is How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them.